You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren.
To the rich man's bright lodges I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
Would there be a run on the dollar because of the growing public debt and budget deficit in the U.S.?
Sure. Well, in reference to the Robert Fisk article, I'm hearing the same thing here in my contacts in Paris and in the Mideast. So I'm hearing the same story. What I'm also hearing is that the basket of currencies that will replace the U.S. dollar will be much more heavily weighted in gold bullion. As much as 50% of the new currency scheme will be weighted in gold bullion. And the point of all this, keep in mind, is that these countries, China, Russia, and Iran, the Shanghai Cooperative Organization, they've made it really no secret that they hope to take down the U.S. economy and take down the U.S. dollar. And this is a move toward taking down the U.S. dollar and the U.S. economy by shifting the way oil is priced out of the world reserve currency, the dollar, which gives America an incredible free pass to finance wars and occupations around the world. China, Iran, and Russia don't want to finance America's military adventures in Afghanistan and Iraq and possibly Iran by allowing the U.S. to have the world's reserve currency, the U.S. dollar, which gives them coinage or the ability to make a profit on every single transaction that is done around the world because it's all done in U.S. dollars. So this is really another step toward the U.S. economy collapsing and the U.S. as a major global power collapsing.
Well, you said that China and Russia are interested in collapsing the U.S. economy, but those countries, plus Japan and the Gulf states, all hold big dollar reserves. So do you think they're interested in really collapsing the U.S. economy?
Yes, well, they're fed up. First of all, that's why you see the gold price moving up right now. It's hitting new all-time historic highs as a way to hedge against the dollar collapse. They're trying to do it in a way that's slower rather than fast. This is a done deal. It's baked into the cake. The U.S. dollar will no longer be the world reserve currency, certainly by 2018. But I have a feeling, based on what I'm hearing and the information that I have just learned in the last 2 hours, that this time schedule that Robert Fisk is portraying, 2018, things are going to be happening a lot faster.
Well, which currencies do you think then could replace the dollar?
Well, as has been mentioned, the idea of a basket, a currency basket. They're already talking about this at the G7, the G4, and the G20, and the International Monetary Fund. We just came out of a major G meeting in Pittsburgh, and the topic of discussion was creating a global currency to replace the U.S. dollar as reserve currency. They already are aware of this. They're talking about a special drawing right, which would allow all the currencies to be recalibrated and then redistributed, with the U.S. dollar taking the biggest devaluation of up to 50%. I would imagine, going forward, which is about what you would need for the U.S. to come in line with the global economy in terms of the incredible debts that the U.S. is carrying, that Asia is financing, that the Mideast is financing, which is one thing. But what they are objecting to, and what I'm hearing from my contacts here in Paris and in the Mideast, is that they don't want to finance America's wars anymore, because the U.S. dollar reserve currency status gives America an incredible leverage in financing wars that they don't really have to pay for. China, Russia, and Iran are paying for America's wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and possibly in Iran. And there's no strategic or philosophical reason why they're making these wars other than the war industry in America controls the White House. Obama works for the war industry, and they need wars to keep profitable, and that's the only reason we're seeing this. And this is why China, Russia, and Iran and these other countries are saying, wait a minute, we don't want to watch as this country, America, really with a horrible economy, huge debts. The only way they can extricate themselves out of their debt problem is to go into countries and commit genocide, or as they've done in Iraq, or support rogue states in the Mideast, you know, undocumented rogue nuclear countries in the Mideast that people object to. So this is what we're seeing. But I think the timetable is going to be a lot sooner than what Robert Fisk is suggesting, 2018. I think we're going to see this things developing a lot quicker.
What impact could the possible demise of the dollar as the world's reserve currency have on the U.S. economy? And can the U.S. do anything to prevent that happening?
Well, the U.S., remember, it's less than 5% of the world's population. And its economy is a large part of the global economy, but it's fueled almost entirely by debt. So if the U.S. economy were to disappear overnight, it wouldn't be as the catastrophe that some in the U.S. argue it might be. Yeah, sure, there would be dislocations in the near term. But look what happened in the scandal last year on Wall Street in 2008. That was completely fabricated by the folks on Wall Street to give themselves a huge bonus. You know, that was a fake, really, collapse that they engineered. And they engineered this rescue from the rest of the world to come bail them out in their bonuses. And the rest of the world is just saying, we're sick of your fake manipulation of your fake currency, your manipulation of the markets, your phony wars, and all the rest of it that goes with having the U.S. dollar as a world reserve currency. So the world is giving America a collective, I can't make the gesture here on television, but it involves the use of a single finger and an outreached arm with a bent elbow.
Thank you very much for your comments. That was Max Keiser, activist and former stockbroker. Thank you very much.
That interview on Russia Today was a response to a recent story by Robert Fisk in the London Independent regarding the abandonment of the U.S. dollar as a world currency used for all purchases of oil. It, of course, has been vigorously denied by respective officials. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. I began with that clip to highlight the extent to which human beings have created a monetary system that has enslaved us, or rather, we have enslaved ourselves and are destroying the Garden of Eden, that is, our planet, and thus ourselves. This week, I will indeed read the very last of Charles Eisenstein's book. It was my interest in the gift economy, in other words, the complete elimination of money, which lies at the heart of the concept of the economy, that led Robin Upton of altruists.org to send me an article by Eisenstein. And thus I ultimately found his book, which I was moved to read to you, because at its core was the critique of our modern world that I shared. Critique is probably not the right word, for I knew it viscerally as a child, too young to even formulate a critique. It was this: the world that Eisenstein calls the separate human realm is ugly, repulsive. My critique was only gained much later when I understood the role of money and the laws created to keep it in place that gave it primacy as the reason humans persisted in creating the kind of ugliness we now have. And this is the greatest tragedy of all, when we have it in us also to create great beauty. We must be militant fighters for great beauty. Eisenstein insists on that right, to paraphrase the Dîné, to walk in beauty, and makes the point that what stands between us and that are the actions of our own species and nothing else. While I concur with what Eisenstein has written probably more than anything else that I have ever read because of the context in which he discusses these issues, there are nonetheless things that he writes that I have a problem with. I'm not sure if I disagree with his ideas or if I'm misunderstanding his ideas because the words he uses are so loaded with other meanings that make it impossible for me to make sense of what he is saying. By this I mean the concept that all this pointless carnage has in fact not been pointless, but has some purpose. To me, the word purpose is inseparable from the existence of a purposer. Who, what, could have a purpose to make such a mess? Yet Eisenstein also asserts that he doesn't believe in a purposer. A listener wrote in a while to mention this contradiction within his writings, and I see it also. On the other hand, Charles repeatedly holds up to ridicule Richard Dawkins' statement that the universe is pitiless, cold, and indifferent. But you know, I think the universe is pitiless, cold, and indifferent, and also the opposite. I don't think it's necessary to decide whether the universe is pitiless or cold, because the point for us is not the universe, but us. Are we to be pitiless, cold, and indifferent? For we all know that our species has displayed that to a great extent, or the opposite, which we've also displayed, to be caring and compassionate and engaged. It is impossible for me to conceive why Gaia, if you want to personify the Earth, would wish to create such a mess upon her face as we have made. Really, we flatter ourselves too much, and that is the whole problem. The idea at the core of separation, that is our notion of being masters of the universe and having dominion over the planet. I'll finish the book today, but not the topic, because this is the topic that now faces us all in all its permutations and ramifications. Next, I'd like to play you an episode from the 300-350 Climate Show, produced by Phil England in London, that looks at the intersection of two converging crises, the so-called economic crisis and the actual climate one.
Welcome to the 300-350 Show, a syndicated radio program that campaigns for a safe climate. And on today's show, we're going to be looking at some of the ways that the climate crunch and the credit crisis are interreacting. But we're going to go straight to an important race now. We can bring you live from the grassy knoll at the Global Meltdown Derby.
Time for the jockeys' nerves to set in. They're under starters' orders. Tsunami waves of fear engulf the market, and they're off. Wave of panic hits, further fragilities predicted, crisis strikes sandy shore, making a pretty good start. Sublime mortgage looking shaky as they come around the first bend. Downright greed from harbing of war, 5 years down the long, torturous, blood-soaked road, loading and fair in Wall Street, following short selling, ninja loans, derivatives, stifling, suffocating sorrow and inner sanctum running well. High rollers rolling in the bankers' gambling bonanza as worldwide famine running good on the inside. James Dane and Bear Stearns looking beleaguered, economic breakdown. Hedge funds defaulters at Beaches Brook, also a faller to FTSE. Worst falls is 9/11. Recession fears spark global share collapse, charging down the field. Blue Mondays followed by Black Wednesdays on from Black Fridays, wiping $77 billion off cities. Blue stocks come to the next fence, with boxer Joe Lewis blowing $1 billion on the day. Credit crunching gowls haunting global market, betting shares collapsing to obscure corners. Financial zombies are surfacing. Another takeover, a lot of turbulence and indiscriminate movement in the middle of the field. Head honchos of Merrill Lynch, Citigroup, Swiss UBS are well out of the race to complete global meltdown. The market is needing more money. Federal Reserve rescue battle for resolution as the Cum Canal turn. Wild durations on Wall Street and Singapore Joe. Singapore Joe injects $5 billion into Merrill. China makes flexes growing financial muscle. Snaps up 12% of Rio Tinto and Dawn raid. Sisyphus the leader. Sisyphus the Puss pushes Northern Rock uphill for eternity. Olympic torch being pushed out of the race. Billions borrowed. Downright greed charging up the hill from excess corporate tax exemptions. And a lot of money buried in tax havens. The drama surrounding big bank bailout unfolding. Debt rising. Greedy speculators spreading scandalously false rumours. Pirate Captain JP Morgan to the rescue train by User of Blair, warmongering peace envoy for the Middle East. Further back, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac and AIG. Toxic assets followed by economic slowdown on from consumer credit with price of commodities, oil, rice, copper and wheat went to an all-time high. Had dramatic effect as we face a deceleration. On from emergency stop, had been travelling at too formidable a pace. Now it's shell-shocked. ExxonMobil announced record profits riding roughshod. H-Bus banks trying to claw their way back from the brink. Back from the brink on from global warming. Global warming running a fast race. Gaia can't take much more. Amazonian forests and other followers have come to the open. ditch. Kevin King pumping more into the financial system, ensuring banks can't be brought down by heavy going. Right there in the centre is liquidity crisis heading for the chair. Frank Lloyd fairing new discrepancy to system. Rogue traders had been jumping well in the middle of the field. Car industry's big tree on the road to ruin. Global warming with sublime. Tens of thousands of homes to be repossessed. Unemployment rising rapidly. Recession followed by depression, pushed hard by Bush Boy. Apocalyptic rider with two left to jump. It's Bush Boy to follow, with Barack Obama looking strong, promising more troops to Afghanistan. Now a select committee taking up the running, putting the pressure on dynamic disgraces. Gracias to whistleblower overtakes fastest chief. Dodgy dealing and using too much whip on from our boss. Flashless Gordon Sir Teddy looking stunned on the rails. Gracias to Amron, another Russian oligarch. Defaulting. Gangrene dinosaurs of world banking gout ridden on their knees with all round profound apologies and more backslapping and backstabbing. Still demanding big, mega big bonuses as economy is careening to disaster. Politicians blown thousands on expenses. Still sitting on many corporate boards as we come to the final fence. Taxpayer left holding banksters illegitimate baby as peripheral countries face famine after years of debt servicing and debt peonage. Harbinger for jumping well is still global warming ahead of worldwide famine on the home straight. Worldwide famine overtaken by downright greed with two farms from home. Global warming is thundering strong on the inside from downright greed, and as to come across the line is global warming ahead of downright greed followed by worldwide famine. Then comes harbinger of war with great cheers from the crowd for the outsider. Global warming.
Okay, you've been listening to the Global Meltdown Derby performed by Grassy Knoll, an Irish poet living in London, who we hope to catch up with at the end of the programme when he's managed to catch his breath back. But I invited Knoll in because I think it's a clever evocation of the converging crisis we now face, and it echoes something that Lord Nicholas Stern said recently in a talk to launch his new book. A member of the audience asked him if there was a danger that politicians would be distracted from the problem of climate change by the economic situation. Only if they have small minds, was his reply. We're going to be looking at the relationship, as I say, between the economic downturn and climate change, and asking whether the former might be our best hope of solving the latter. And this is one of the questions I put to Tim Helveg Larsen, director of the Public Interest Research Centre think tank, who was a co-author of the important Zero Carbon Britain and Climate Safety Reports. Before we hear that interview, though, Kevin Anderson, research director of the Tyndall Centre, the UK's leading climate change policy research institution, speaking at the launch of the Climate Safety Report back in November 2008 and reinforcing the message from last week's programme about the need to move international and national climate policy away from long-term targets to emissions budgets and emissions trajectories.
Now, targets, traditionally, I think probably many of you have heard about this recently, we've talked about long-term targets, 80% reduction by 2050 or 60% reduction by 2050. It's all about 2050 or 2100. It's not about now. Out of our term of office, I think is one of the terms some people use. CO2 stays in the atmosphere for well over 100 years, well in excess of that now. So, in fact, that's not really the appropriate way to look at the problem. You really have to say that these final percentage reductions have almost nothing to do with climate change. What matters are the cumulative emissions, as the emissions build up day in, day out, year in, year out. This fundamentally rewrites the whole chronology of climate change. It moves us away from these long-term gradual reductions that we traditionally are used to, towards urgent and radical reductions. This is Mr. Stern again. Annual reductions of greater than 1% per annum only ever been associated with economic recession or upheaval. We're getting a bit more used to this now anyway. But that was only 1%. Now let's look at the best example we actually have of doing something. The UK dash for gas, big reduction from emissions because we swapped from coal to gas, or the French 40-fold increase in nuclear power over about 20 years. These are the best examples that we've got of moving into a low-carbon supply route. It wasn't for those reasons, but that's what we did. They were only linked with about a 1% per annum reduction, and that excluded aviation and shipping. So basically, the best example we have historically had no reduction in emissions. But there is an example out there which you can rely on. The collapse of the Soviet Union gave us 5% reduction in emissions per annum for about 10 years. A reality check on this. If economic growth is not possible with 6% per annum reductions in emissions, and I think most of us would probably say that's a little unlikely, then we have no option, it would appear to me, I would look forward to hearing any other options than this, than having a planned economic recession.
Kevin Anderson, he's basically arrived at the conclusion that what we need is a planned economic contraction on an unprecedented scale, perhaps a kind of faster wind down of economic activity than they saw in Russia during the 1990s. We could say in climate terms that it's been lucky for us that we have had such a downturn over the last year or so. Does it look likely that emissions are coming down as a result of that?
It does look like they are coming down. I haven't seen the very latest figures, but a couple of months ago it was looking like the UK's emissions had dropped by 2% against the same time in the previous year. And it's a tricky one to manage and understand because it basically complicates the climate change message. Here we are in a situation where we can see fossil fuel use has been growing exponentially, and the message must clearly be that we have to stop that. And then if emissions cuts come from an unexpected quarter, namely economic recession or depression, how do we deal with that? And surely we should be grateful for those cuts, but they also come with pain, obviously. And there's a climate change concern as well, that we need to make absolutely sure that these cuts, wherever they come from, are locked in. So when Kevin Anderson talks about a planned economic recession, that's absolutely the last thing anyone in the world of politics or business wants to hear. But there's more than a grain of truth in what he's saying, that we really do need very large short-term cuts. I saw in figures that came out just yesterday were showing that Germany over the last year has its GDP has dropped by over 6%. And I think, if I remember Kevin Anderson's figures correctly, Russia was collapsing at 5% a year. So Germany is already experiencing that in the last year, and this last quarter seems to be even more harsh. I think what this all stems from is really that we've been finding it much easier to borrow money than to save money. And when you have this ready access to money and the purchasing power that it brings, it means you can buy an awful lot more fossil fuel and an awful lot more capacity to burn it than you would have if you were busy saving. So when we hear about credit crunch, it's really saying that there's a, if not an end, a pause or a stop in that process of accessing money beyond our means, and therefore accessing carbon and fossil fuels beyond our means. The idea of emissions reductions coming from unexpected quarters isn't completely off the wall. Terry Barker is the director of the Cambridge Centre for Climate Change Mitigation Research, and he was saying that in the Great Depression, emissions fell by some 35% between 1929 and 1932, and he's predicting an even greater fall with the recession or depression, as he sees it, that we're going into. And he was quoted at the end of last year as saying that he thinks that the downturn is much more severe than economists realise, and we may see a 40 to 50% CO2 emissions fall globally between now and 2012. Now, if we do see a 40 or 50% emissions cut globally, then that is more than anyone been conceivably hoping for from a climate change perspective. And we will need to move very fast to both support the humanitarian impacts of that economic, well, freefall, but then also to lock in the carbon savings that come with it. I think it's going to take a very careful look to see who is suffering and where the pain is. We clearly don't need to worry too much about screams from bankers, but there are going to be real people all over the world who are affected by an economic collapse of that order. And I don't really know if that's what the probability or likelihood of that happening is, but I wouldn't discount it entirely. I think when we talk about sustainability or unsustainability, we're talking about a period within now or the next 12, 24, 36 months probably, where we find that you cannot sustainably travel up an exponential curve. At some point it collapses, and that's the case as much for our money system as it might be for our access to fossil fuels.
I mean, also, if it wasn't for the climate situation, which has a greater urgency, I think it's clear now, we'd also be seeing some economic contraction ahead through peaking oil supplies, which somebody like Colin Campbell has made clear.
Yeah.
But Ed Miliband is resisting the idea that we should start talking about a non-growth story, so a low-carbon future that isn't about economic growth and is more about well-being. His argument is that if we say that a low-carbon future is a low-growth story or a negative growth story, then China won't sign on to an international deal. Have you got a response to that?
Well, I think what Mr. Miliband is probably experiencing is that there is a very rich and detailed and prosperous picture that's been painted of a world in growth. And the same rich and detailed picture hasn't yet, I don't think, been painted for a steady state economy, for a sustainable economy. And that's absolutely something that we should be supporting him in. Maybe it's for him to do himself, but when he says that a steady state economy is not a message that is going to be swallowed by China, we have to ask ourselves, why is it that we haven't been able to communicate the sort of the extra benefits of even the economic benefits of efficiency, the economic benefits of using renewables instead of fossil fuels, the social benefits of getting to know your neighbours more by moving more locally, being closer to the means of production for your food and your services. That picture is still fairly clunky and clumsy. I find it clunky and clumsy to talk about because it's so foreign from the world we live in today. But we need to build that picture in a very rich and detailed way if we want to draw politicians and countries towards it.
Okay. Again, going back to Kevin Anderson and Alice Bowes, we have this tiny emissions budget available to us, and we really want to get to zero carbon as soon as possible,
yep.
I think is the message of the Climate Safety Report. And you factored in all the observational science that's coming out of the Arctic.
Yep.
So, yeah, what Kevin Anderson and Alice Bowes have been saying for some time now is that really to keep within such a tight budget, we really need to act fast and to make early cuts as soon as possible.
Absolutely.
And one of the biggest tools we've got in our kind of policy box is demand reduction.
Yep.
And they say we should refocus on demand reduction. But again, this isn't something that the government is starting to talk about or appears to have heard currently.
I think it's the same issue as steady state instead of growth. Demand reduction is absolutely talking about moving on to a steady state footing. And it's not as politically attractive as the fashionable story of growth. There are all sorts of technical reasons and social reasons why a steady-state economy would be a better economy and a more wholesome and fulfilling economy than a growth one, and why demand reduction is absolutely needed. What we've got to do, it's incumbent on all of us, is to find the ways to communicate that. I think the key point is from Kevin and Alice is unavoidable. We have to be making these cuts, and we have to be making them now. And what we saw very clearly as we got to the end of writing the Climate Safety Report was that really any stabilisation level for greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, whether it's 450, 550, or down at 350, or even lower, if you want any hope or any chance of reaching those, you have to be on the reductions track right now. You have to be moving hard and fast towards zero carbon right now. And so really, given the uncertainty about climate change, and yet given the very large scale of it and the great urgency that we're seeing from work looking at carbon budgets that Anderson and Bowes are doing, it's clear that we have to just get on that track. And only once we're on that track, racing out of carbon, will we have the luxury to fine-tune our trajectory and see if or what stabilisation level we need to stabilise at.
George Monbiot was saying we could reduce carbon emissions by 25% by 2012, which is very soon and very,
yeah,
very quick. I'm not sure if anyone's looked at his suggestions and whether they stack up or not.
Yeah.
But if the UK government kind of took this approach, there'd be certain an advantage in us leading from the front in that way, yeah?
Yeah, it's absolutely a reason and a need to, as you say, lead from the front. I think the way I would look at it or frame it is that the negotiations that we've had internationally, these UN climate negotiations, have embodied a culture of apportioning blame, really, or apportioning, they talk about burden sharing. It's like there's this much burden. Obviously, we're trying to avoid the burden of climate change, but we have to take on the burden of economic hardship. So let's split it like this, and you take all of that economic hardship, and I'll just take this little bit of economic hardship. So it's all sort of pushing around hardship and burden, responsibility, and really, if we as a nation can, if Britain or any country, in fact, can actually start demonstrating that they are making real cuts in greenhouse gas emissions now, and that they're doing it because it's the right thing to do, and they're doing it because it saves them money. They're saving money because they are more efficient in the way they use energy, and they're saving money because the energy that they do use is coming from renewable sources, which means that they don't have to pay for fossil fuels. So if Britain can go into those international negotiations and say, this is the cut that we are making now. We're making a cut now because we have to be on this track out of carbon, and we're making this cut now because it's right for an awful lot of reasons. And how can we learn from the rest of the world about the approaches that they're taking, and how can we help the rest of the world? That would be such a completely different approach. It would, I think, change the game if countries could go in with that positive attitude of this is what we're doing. Because a nation faces the same problem that any individual faces with climate change, which is that for the climate change to be solved, or for us even to begin solving climate change, we have to take action ourselves, and we have to trust that everyone else is going to take action. And it's a very difficult thing to do because we aren't in control of everybody else. And all we can do is to take action ourselves and show the world, show other people that we're doing it and that it's the right thing to do, and hope and trust that they will do so too.
Okay. Going back to demand reduction, the Zero Carbon Britain report was basically a mixture of power down and power up.
Yep.
So in terms of power down, that's demand reduction, just using less,
yeah,
reducing our energy demand overall by 50% was the scenario.
Yeah.
And that was achieved through carbon rationing. Is that still your preferred method or approach to demand management?
I think it is. There's,
or a version of that, because there's domestic tradable quotas and tradable energy quotas as well.
One has changed name into the other now. I think that there are a number of advantages through doing it with a scheme like tradable energy quotas. It means that you start off with a very clear cap that is designed to match the amount of carbon that been scientifically decided we can burn, and then it provides a first approximation, a very good approximation, I would hope, at sharing that carbon out equitably. And what it crucially does, which might otherwise be missed, is that it engages everybody in the country in an awareness of this carbon problem and of getting off this carbon problem. So if any individual person is going to buy petrol or gas or a sack of coal even, they have to hand over these carbon permits. And so it makes those fossil fuel, those carbon transactions, feel very real to people. And it provides a way of, if you like, uniting all the people and businesses in the country with the government to tackle this problem and get really creative and innovative about finding ways of avoiding using these fossil fuels.
Do you have any other big picture stuff that you'd like to throw in about what the science is really telling us now in terms of how we need to move forward?
Well, in terms of big picture, you've quite rightly pointed to the need for demand reduction as the first port of call, and it absolutely is. I'm guilty as the next person that I find it easier to sell the idea of renewable energy than I do of making savings. And so with that caveat in place, I'll just tell you what's exciting me at the moment, which is that Britain has an absolutely vast energy potential offshore, both in terms of our offshore wind resource, but also the untapped wave and tidal potential. The point I always make about marine technologies, wave and tidal, is that moving water being 1,000 times denser than air, moving water is carrying 1,000 times the energy of air that moves at the same speed. Now, it doesn't always move at the same speed, and there are different places where you'll be able to tap it than you can tap wind. But that's a technology that we've only just begun to get a sniff at, and it's not surprising that the marine technologies that have been shown to succeed or have been most promising were not the ones that were designed to be most efficient. They were the ones that were designed to survive. And the technology has moved on a little bit further now, so that it's now not just the technologies that were able to survive those incredibly powerful conditions, but it's the ones that are cost-effective to maintain. So where you can lift them out of the water, for instance, very easily and change the bearings or re-grease this or that. So I'm very keen to understand the full economic value of our offshore renewable resource. And the reason that I say the economic value is that I suspect that the economic value of our of our renewables will get far more traction within Whitehall than will an understanding of the energy potential or of the carbon mitigation potential of that energy. And I think when we look into it, which it's only a matter of time before these numbers start surfacing, what we'll see is that it's going to be worth hundreds of billions of pounds. We've got the single largest offshore wind resource of any country in Europe, and it's significantly larger than our domestic demand for energy. And what we need to recognise is that actually that offshore potential is an export commodity for Britain. It's something that we could be exporting into Europe as zero carbon electricity, and it can also be saving us money through avoided fossil fuel imports for our own energy use. And in doing that, we're going to build an absolutely world-class expertise in these technologies, which is yet another sort of economic boost. So I'm very keen to see numbers put to this and to see a full economic valuation of our vast offshore energy gold mine, really.
That was Tim Helveg Larsen, Director of the Public Interest Research Centre think tank and co-author of the Zero Carbon Britain and Climate Safety Reports, with some useful insights, I think, there. And we still have Grassy Knoll in the studio with us. We're seeing how Shell works firsthand in the battle that they're having. I think it's been going on for 9 years in County Mayo. Perhaps you could bring us up to speed on what's happening there and what that campaign is all about.
Well, the campaign, as he's rightly said, began 9 years. Shell have been trying to build a massive big refinery in Mayo. The land was more or less given to them by the Irish government for a very, very minimal fee. It was land that was originally forestry land. It's in a beautiful estuary. It's an environmentally protected area. And at this moment in time, they're trying to make the final link up to the pipeline. On last year, there was a big problem because Shell were unable to link up because Moira Harrington, one of the local teachers, a retired teacher, now went in hunger strike and disabled Shell by proceeding with the works at that moment in time, because they thought internationally it would be a fiasco with the negative publicity had she died in this particular moment. And at the moment, there's a lot of fishermen still involved in the campaign, a lot of the local farmers. Indeed, Willie Carduff was nearly beaten very, very badly by the security, 15 of security, dressed in black with black balaclavas, and the second anniversary of him winning an international environmental award.
Right, so the struggle goes on. And I understand that there's been a link, a kind of solidarity between the campaigns in Nigeria and County Mayo as well.
Well, at this moment in time, I'd like to say there's been a lot of international solidarity, and Ken Saraway's brother has come over, his nephew, as far as I'm aware, has been over there. A lot of other support has come in from Nigeria. A lot of support has come from England over the years as well. It's one of the things that people overlook, that the English have actually, a lot of people have gone over to the camp, and a lot of people have actually supported it. A lot of people throughout the world have come to Ireland to actually support this particular fight, because it is a very, very small amount of farmers that are putting up a very, very good fight against a transnational corporation. One of the wealthiest last year, they announced their profit. I think it's the biggest corporate profit that any company in Britain has ever made.
And there must be a web link for the County Mayo campaign as well.
Yes, shelltoseed.com. I think for the sake of the environment and the whole west coast of Ireland, there's a lot of oil, a lot of gas out there. I mean, once the gas is in, presumably the oil will follow, and it'll have detrimental effects to the whole west coast of Ireland.
And just to say, references for this week's programme and to listen again, go to climateradio.org. And thanks for listening.
That was Phil England from London with his 300-350 Climate Show. Next, this is from a classic series, from Naked Ape to Super Species. Produced at the turn of the century by geneticist turned broadcaster David Suzuki from Canada, that was done for the CBC. It dramatizes much of what Charles has written regarding a coming full circle in human understanding.
Hello, I'm David Suzuki. Human beings have undergone fundamental changes that have transformed us into a new kind of force. Never before, in the 4 billion year history of life on Earth, has a single species been able to alter the geological, biological, and physical features of the planet. We have evolved from naked ape to super species. From Naked Ape to Super Species, a special 8-part series on human culture and its impact on the natural world. As children, some of the earliest words and pictures we learn are frog and tree, kitty cat and dog, monkey and elephant. We know our world is filled with other creatures, and we learn to love them. But plants and animals are far more than just pets or pretty ornaments. The array of living things in the world is essential for our survival. They make the world work. If you want to appreciate how complex it all is, try to imagine making a closed environment that supplies everything you need to survive. Try to imagine making it from scratch, the way astronauts would in a space colony. Gretchen Daly thinks about these things. She's an ecologist at Stanford University.
So imagine that a year from now, a spaceship's going to arrive in your backyard and take you off to the moon. And the big question you have then is, you know, how are you going to plan your trip? You've got a year to do it. You're going to live on the moon forever. What are you going to bring with you? Maybe your thoughts would turn, mine probably would, first to my favorite music or my best friends and family that I'd want to persuade to bring with me, my pets or who knows what. You know, maybe you'd start getting practical and thinking about handyman books and stuff that you'd need up there. But eventually you'd have to turn your mind to the issue of what you're going to eat. You know, what kinds of other organisms besides your pets are you going to bring up there to make a happy life possible on the moon? And we're going to assume for the sake of argument that the moon already has in place some of the conditions, you know, critical to human life, like a reasonable atmosphere and climate and maybe the physical structure of soil. Okay, so then you could start going through all the things maybe that you ate for breakfast and for dinner last night.
If you think about it, every bit of our nutrition, the food we eat to stay healthy, comes from living things. When you buy cornflakes or frozen pizza, you think it was manufactured by a company. But all the ingredients were once alive.
You know, what really goes into cornflakes? You might be horrified to find out, but you could start listing the things that you pull off the supermarket shelf, not really thinking about what it is, but list all those species. Then you could think about, well, what medicines have you used in the past year? Most medicines are derived from other organisms, mainly plants, but a lot from microorganisms, some from vertebrates and other things like snakes. Anyway, your list would, especially if you wanted to bring stuff up there to make the landscape look pretty for the kids, and you know, you'd be thinking about them not wanting to miss out on the butterflies and birds and flowers and so on. So your list would probably be, even if you were being pretty selective, it would add up to the hundreds or even possibly thousands of species before you'd even begun to consider what you'd have to bring up there to allow all those things to live with you. That's no Sunday afternoon task.
Designing a whole package containing everything we'd need to live on the moon is a pretty big challenge. Let's try something simpler. Let's take one part of the package, soil. What if all you had to worry about was making soil work? Gretchen Daly.
Some people looked at what was living under a square meter of Earth. So they sort of scooped it up, took it into the lab, and they found just the sorts of things that you could see with the naked eye. They found over 50,000 small earthworms and their relatives. They found 50,000 different types of insects and mites. And then they found 12 million roundworms and their relatives. Okay, and that's just the stuff that you can see. I mean, they were probably blind by the end of doing this, but someone on the team then took a pinch of that soil and looked at the microorganisms in it. And there you find even more. I mean, it's just incredible. They found under the microscope 30,000 protozoa, 50,000 algae, 400,000 fungi, and billions of individual bacteria of unknown numbers of species. Okay, so now think about that for a minute. Which of those are you going to bring to the moon with you? You know, how are you going to cart them up there? And I mean, basically what you realize is that if the spaceship did land in your yard, you might say, forget it. I'm not into adventures. I'll just stay right here where I am.
love the idea of exploring space because it's an unknown frontier. But Gretchen Daly's moon story makes us realize we don't know that much about how it all works down here, or even who's home. For example, biologists aren't even sure how many species have been scientifically cataloged. And when I say cataloged, all that means is we've given a name to a dead specimen. Biologists have identified somewhere between 1.5 and 1.7 million species so far, but we don't know how many there are out there in total. There are ways to make an educated guess, and that, most biologists now agree, is about 10 million. This means we know perhaps 15 to 20% of all the life forms on land, at sea, and in fresh water. And when it comes to bacteria and other microorganisms, well, we don't have any idea at all. If there's anybody who knows what we don't know, it's Edward O. Wilson. He's a professor of ecology at Harvard University, and he's written many books, including two Pulitzer Prize winners. E.O. Wilson once told me he calculated that more money is spent in bars in New York City in 2 weeks than is spent around the world in a whole year surveying plants and animals. No wonder we know so little about them. We've only had a word to describe all this abundance of life since the mid-1980s. The word is biodiversity.
Biodiversity is the short word for biological diversity. And actually it means something everyone is familiar with. It means the creation, literally. It means the diversity of all forms of life on Earth. And that includes the variety of natural ecosystems from the open ocean to marsh to rainforest. It means the variety of plants and animals and microorganisms, the species that make up those ecosystems. And finally, it means the variety in the genes that prescribe the characteristics of those organisms. And beyond that, it is a precious bequest that nature has given to us. Those species, millions of species that are out there, are on the average, depending on the group of organisms, whether, say, trees or butterflies, a 500,000 to 10 million years old. And they've taken that time to become exquisitely well adapted to the environment, fitting together to create these ecosystems on which our very existence depends.
The concept of biodiversity doesn't just mean all the different creatures that live on this planet. It includes the work they do together to create the life cycles on which we all depend. They make air, water, and soil, and cleanse all our wastes. For example, green plants turn sunlight into energy, which they provide to the rest of us when we eat them. Microorganisms in the soil filter our water. Biologists term these processes ecosystem services. We can't live without the rest of life, but that feeling isn't entirely mutual. E.O. Wilson.
To get perspective on the interdependence of different life forms on Earth, I like to use this example. If all humanity disappeared, then, how can I put it without sounding callous? The rest of life would benefit enormously. The forests would grow back. The whole earth would green up again. The oceans would teem and so on. Of course, there would be no truly intelligent creature around to enjoy it. If, on the other hand, let's take an example of one of the most abundant animals on the land, in addition to humanity. Take the ants. If the ants were all to disappear, the results would be close to catastrophic because the ants turn a very large part of our soil. They turn as much soil as earthworms in the north temperate zone, and they turn much more of the soil than earthworms and most other creatures in the tropics. They are the major predators of other insects and keep the cycle going that way. They are the chief scavengers of small animals, removing over 90% of small dead creatures, and so on and on. If they were all disappear, there would be major extinctions of other species and probably even partial collapse of some ecosystems. So biodiversity would suffer.
We have always lived on a planet bursting with an almost incalculable number of life forms. For most of human existence, it seemed impossible that we could ever have any effect on such things as the skies, the mountains, and the seas. Our wealth was not only incalculable, it kept renewing itself. But now we can poison the skies, level mountains, and fish the seas bare. In this century, human beings have exploded in numbers, consumption, and technological muscle power. And this has put enormous pressure on other species, driving many of them out of existence. But the fact is, 99% of all of the species that have ever existed went extinct before we humans even got here. So extinction is natural. Why worry? E.O. Wilson.
The idea that extinction is natural, that evolution will replace the species that are lost, and so has it ever been since the beginning of life. Humanity is just the latest agent of extinction, and if we're really part of nature, we ought to accept that. This is what I call one of the great forms of denial about the environment. It overlooks the fact that those 99% of species that became extinct are spread out over 3 billion years. You know, there's this turnover. The average life of a species, and this is what should matter to humanity, is on the order of 1 million years. And we are drastically shortening that lifetime for species. And since it takes a long time, thousands to millions of years, to create as fully developed a species as the ones around us, then we are doing the equivalent of drawing down hard on our bank account. We are destroying species at a far faster rate. We estimate somewhere between 100 times and 1,000 times faster than species could be created, even if we left the natural environment alone. And, you know, you can't be drawing down, say conservatively, on your bank account at 100 times the rate you're putting new money in without growing broke very fast.
Our biological bank account is based on energy from the sun. Plants capture sunlight and convert it into sugars, which are used for energy by all the rest of life up and down the food chain. Every living thing needs energy to perpetuate itself. The ability of all species to reproduce and grow is our biological capital. Growth and reproduction, beyond what's needed to keep a species going, is our biological interest. We can use our interest, catching fish or cutting down trees, without endangering a species. But we run into trouble when we start dipping into our capital. Stuart Pym is an eminent conservation biologist from the University of Tennessee. He's one of the scientists who's been paying attention to our biological spending habits.
Let me give you a brief tour of what we're doing to the planet. If you take away the frozen bits of the planet, the area of the planet is about 130 million square kilometers. Of that, we take up about 15 million square kilometers for our agriculture. And almost all of that agriculture is cut into areas that were once forest. We have to also add into the calculation the amount of woodlands that we consume for fuel, which is a very large fraction. We also log large portions of the planet. We also graze parts of the planet, about something like 60 million square kilometers of the planet, about half of the non-frozen area, is pasture land of one kind or another. If you begin to think of the scale of that, 50 million square kilometres for agriculture, 60 million for grazing of one kind or another, the amount of forests we use. So the answer is about half. About half of the biological interest of the planet we are already consuming. That's sort of the bad news, because we know from the projections of human population growth that our human population is likely to double. And if you think what you see now in terms of the loss of biodiversity is bad, imagine what it will be like in 30, 40 years' time when the world's population has doubled. But in fact, there's bad news and there's worse news. We, humanity, have highlighted the planet. We have taken the best bits. The forests of Europe, Japan, of North America are the bits that are just right. Not too hot, not too cold, not too wet, not too dry. What we are doing now is, having taken the best bits of the planet, as our population expands, it is moving into the areas that are not so good. We're moving into the areas of the planet that are basically indigestible.
The parts of the planet that are not so good for us are the richest in terms of biodiversity: tropical and boreal forests, coral reefs, and wetlands. As we begin to invade them, we're putting tremendous pressure on millions of species. We're accelerating the rate of extinction. Stuart Pym.
11% of all birds are on the verge of extinction as a consequence of what we've done now. A report published in the last couple of weeks for the world's plants suggests that 12% of the world's plants are on the brink of extinction. And I suspect that's an underestimate, because there are many plants that we don't know, and what we don't know are likely to be rare, and they're likely to be even more vulnerable. It's not just on land, it's in the oceans, it's in our rivers. A greater fraction of our freshwater fish, and a huge fraction of freshwater clams and mussels are on the verge of extinction. The pattern is ubiquitous. Whenever we have sufficient data, we recognize that something between 10 and 40% of the world's species are already on the verge of extinction.
There have been major episodes of extinction in the past. The fossil record tells us that five times so far, huge numbers of species suddenly disappeared. And some people think we're in the middle of a sixth. In each case in the past, new species evolved and made up for the ones that disappeared. The last big extinction spasm eliminated the dinosaurs, and that made way for the mammals and us. So what's the concern? E.O. Wilson.
I think most people are now aware that about 65 million years ago, what is now Yucatan got smacked by a 10-mile-wide comet or meteor that created tremendous seismic shocks all around the world, and, as one geologist put it, rang the world like a bell, causing giant tsunamis and massive extinctions, including probably the last of the dinosaurs. We are now in the beginnings, I think most experts on biodiversity agree, of similar extinction episodes, except now we are the comet, and we could end up having a similar result as what happened 65 million years ago, ending the age of dinosaurs. And I like to say that what we will have is the Eremozoic age. Eremozoic means, that's the word I coined, that means the age of loneliness. That is, we will be in an impoverished world of our own making. Evolution will replace that. But after each great extinction episode, like the one that happened 65 million years ago, each of those extinction episodes required about 10 million years to fully replace that which was lost very abruptly. And if we go on wiping out a large part of the fauna and flora of the world, and our descendants, you know, as early as 2050, realize that because of our recklessness, they're going to have to wait 10 million years to see a return of the world's biota and fauna and flora. They are going to be, how can I put it,
peeved.